Let me start the recording. So we are now recording, and I'll just say for the record, it is 1 p.m. Houston, Texas time, and 2 p.m. 2:07, I should say, Dr. DeAngelis's time. And I'm Tacy Ann Wasilowski, interviewing Dr. Catherine DeAngelis for our second session of the Oral History Project run for the Women in Medicine Legacy Foundation. So thanks very much for joining me again for this interesting conversation.
My pleasure.
And we ended up last time with you about to come to Hopkins and for a residency program. So, you know, I wanted to ask you if you knew at that time that you were going to have a career in academic medicine. Was that something that you had fixed on pretty early?
I was thinking about it because I had done research in medical school, and I really liked that setting very much. So, of course, my dad had the place in our little town where I grew up. He had the place all set where I was going to set up my practice, right in that little town. And I had to disappoint him. I said, yeah, you know, Poppy, I can't do that. I was, you know, I said, I'm pretty sure I want to do academia, but that's why I'm going to Hopkins. And he said, well, whatever makes you happy, we'll see what happens. So
what was it that you enjoyed so much about the research environment, the academic environment?
Well, the academic environment completely. I mean, it was, if I had a medical question, that it was possible for me to, I knew how to do research, and so I could get the answer. I also loved teaching. I loved helping younger, I loved with the medical students at that point, because I was just coming off being a medical student. And in my class, I was one of the oldest members of my medical school class. I was 4 years, 3 to 4 years older than the others. And because of my background in nursing, it was sort of natural. And so I was just so looking forward to the day of seeing what it was like in this place that was known for research and for excellent teaching. So, the interesting thing about this was that I had applied to the Hopkins Community Program, never thinking I could get into the Harriet Lane Residency Program. They had a more of a clinical site. I had been accepted to Denver's program, which was my second choice. And I called the office to see where they were with my, because I had sent an application there. And the chair of the department answered the phone himself. And I was sort of dumbstruck. And I said, this is Kathy DeAngelis. He said, oh, did you get my letter? And my heart sunk because I thought the letter was, you know, we're sorry, we can't take you. But instead he said, look, I don't want you, you're going to come here, but not in the community program. I want you in the Harriet Lane program. I almost fell off my chair. It's like my wildest dream.
Did he say why?
And he said, I have an opening. He said, and would you like to do that? I said, are you kidding? Of course. Later, this is what's going to get much later, I found out that my husband, my future husband, had been slated for that slot, but he decided he wanted to do that year in Rochester. And so they said, okay, you can come the next year. That leaves us with a spot. And Dr. Cook said, I have another candidate. So I took my future husband's spot. And if he had come, I would have been in the community program.
Right.
So wow. You see what great. God is a comedian. He's the great comedian. That's no really, question.
It's really funny. It's really funny. So tell me how you found Hopkins when you arrived. I mean, kind of globally. Was it what you had anticipated?
Yes, and then some. It was an incredible place. It was a place that was, I mean, it was all subspecialty oriented, but the training was incredible. And, you know, this was 1970, so the residents pretty much ran the place. The senior residents ran it. The others, you know, were there, and you took responsibility for your patients. I mean, the attendings were right there when you needed them, but you ran the program, and the senior residents were there. And
so it's just enormous experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was, at that point, we were working every other night, every other weekend. So it wasn't, you know, so we pretty much, when we say house officer, we meant it. Mm-hmm. So we all lived within, well, it had to be within 5 minutes of the hospital. And, you know, it was just terrific. And there was no such thing as working any specific hour. You know, you work the day, but your day shift, you started at about 7. And then you did night rounds at 9 p.m. So, you know, but it was wonderful. And even because you were there every other night, every other weekend, I mean, we had drug engagement parties. We even had a bris. We celebrated a bris. We celebrated birthdays. I had a lot of dates there, having dinner in the hospital cafeteria with someone. I mean, it was, so you were really engaged.
Yeah.
And to this day, I was the only woman in the group, mm-hmm. but to this day, I'm very close to all of those people.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, you've described the past scenarios where, you know, faculty kind of had a different attitude about women students than the actual class, your colleagues in class. What was Hopkins' level of commitment to bringing in women and supporting them and retaining them in these various programs at this time in the 70s?
Well, I was the only woman in my group, mm-hmm. but I was treated the same as all the guys. The only difference was when I was covering the outpatient department along with, you know, the guys, anytime a woman, a girl would come in, if she was between the ages of 11 or older and had a complaint, anything to do with from navel to knees, they'd put it in my box. They didn't know how to handle it. Which was fine with me. I was okay with that. But except for that, no, there was no difference. And then the next year, there were, I think, two or three women in the next class. But, you know, it was, you were treated just, you were a Hopkins resident. And a Hopkins resident was treated like a Hopkins resident.
I'm sorry.
The expectations were high. If you met the expectations, you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Were there kind of incidences of microaggression, you know, kind of comments about women? What was that environment like? How aware were people of not saying things like that?
Well, I do not recall anyone making any comment at all because I was a woman. There weren't that many women faculty, and certainly just a smattering of women professors, no department chair. I mean, it was much later that the first woman department chair was named. In fact, I was on the faculty for a while, went before the first woman department chair was named. And we've never had a woman dean, but as a resident, it was no, I don't recall anything like that. Now, subsequently, it was the business of equal salary if you were hired. I mean, the residents all got the same salary, so that wasn't a problem. But it was thereafter that there was this difference.
Issues of equity, yeah. I'd like to kind of get to the kind of formal start, you know, of your academic career once you go to Columbia. But is there anything between that time of your residency and starting as a faculty member at Columbia that you feel is important to touch on that you didn't touch on in your memoir?
Well, I think I touched on it, and that is that I was offered, because they trained subspecialists. Mm-hmm. We didn't even have a general pediatric program. There was in-house medicine, and we refer to it as outhouse medicine, which means outpatient. Mm-hmm. And there was a chief resident for the inpatient and a chief resident for the outpatient. But the outpatient chief became the inpatient. It was like you had to do penance for a year. So you could see, you know, everybody was expected to be a subspecialist. And I was offered three different fellowships when I left. And I turned them all down. And they couldn't believe it. I turned them down because I wanted to go up to Harvard to get an MPH.
Right.
I didn't want to go there to get an MPH. I wanted to go there to learn something. But I found out when I went up there to look at the programs that if I applied for an NIH grant to get my MPH, they'd pay my tuition plus give me a stipend. My goodness, how great. They paid me to study. Yeah. There you go.
Seriously. Now, what were you hoping that the MPH would add to your perspective as a physician?
Well, I didn't care about the degrees. As I said, you know, I already had plenty of degrees. And as I said in my book, no matter how many degrees you get, you'll never get as many as a thermometer. And you know where that ends up. So the heck with degrees. I went up there, I wanted to learn. I knew when I saw all these patients in the outpatient department, I saw all these general problems that fascinated me. You know, the kid who'd come in and it wasn't a diabetic or a thyroid problem or a cancer problem or a cardiac problem, but it was a mystery. That's what fascinated me. This was the plain child, you know, ordinary, came in and it was a diagnostic dilemma. That to me was general pediatrics. That along with making sure kids stayed well. And so what I wanted to do, I mean, I had been a nurse and I knew that nurses, you know, with just a bit more training could handle a lot of the problems, especially the well child stuff. And they could make a diagnosis or at least know that it was beyond them. And at that point, you could be called in. So that if you were a general pediatrician, in my head, you would work with the nurse practitioner who would take care of, you know, the everyday kinds of problems, but you were there to take care of the problems that she couldn't handle. Now you wanted to do some of the well child stuff yourself, but that was up to you. And so I wanted to start a nurse practitioner program. Now I knew there was one in Colorado and I wasn't quite sure exactly what they were training nurses to do, but I knew what I wanted to train them to do. So when I left, I went up to Boston and I wanted to learn the law. I wanted a bit about the law, you know, the medical law. And I wanted to know about medical economics, because if you're going to start something that you know you at that point didn't have as much value as the subspecialists, you better figure out economically how you're going to handle that. And how are you going to handle paying the nurse practitioner? So I went up to Harvard, and the only courses they said you had to take was biostatistics and epidemiology. I didn't want to take those courses. I already had that in medical school, and I knew I was going to forget, you know, we used to call it biostatistics. And I didn't want to waste my time learning that stuff. I wanted to know about law, and I also wanted to write, at first it wasn't a book, but it was a manual to teach the nurse practitioners. And I took a course in design of a course. And I, the third week in, I was teaching it, how to teach, you know, because I was using the model in my head of how to teach nurse practitioners. So I wrote the book for the first textbook for nurse practitioners. I wrote it in 1970. It was published in 74, I believe. And the nice thing was there was a program there that kind of trained nurse practitioners, but they had no book. It was taught by nurses, and it was not the same. So I asked the woman who ran the course. She was at Northeastern University, at the School of Medicine. And I said to her, look, I have a material for teaching, and I'd be happy to help teach this if you'll allow me to use this and get some feedback about how useful. Well, of course, she's so fantastic, Priscilla Andrews. And we just hit it off. So I taught those nurses. She did most of the teaching. I just taught that one section and got feedback on my book. She was so taken with the book that she told her friends at Little Brown about this book. And she said to me, I want you to send this to Little Brown and Company because I think this is a book. Well, I said, you know, I typed that on an electric typewriter. I'm a terrible typist. But I bought a used electric typewriter, and I typed the book up. And I said, well, here you have it. Give it to your friends. I don't care what they do with it. I just want people to use it. Well, they published it. Mm-hmm. And so I then had a book to take with me at my first job.
No, and I wasn't... I was going to ask if this perspective of teaching nurses to have a wider scope of influence was somewhat controversial at the time. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
And what were the arguments against?
You know, the nurses were against it. It was interesting because I'll expand on that in a minute. But so while I was still. There were two things I was battling at the time. One was to get the course together. The second was there was no law course per se, but I took some courses that had to do with just some basic kind of legal stuff. From Rashi Fine, who actually worked for three presidents. He was an economist. And so I took the economics and the accounting kind of stuff. But I wanted to learn from Bill Curran. And he was the lawyer who wrote twice a month, I believe it was, in the New England Journal of Medicine. He wrote about medical legal issues, but he had no course he was teaching. So I went to him and I asked if I could meet with him. And he said, well, sure. He said, I'll have, you know, some time while I'm eating lunch. And what is it that you want? And I told him that I wanted to learn about health law. I told him about my idea. And he said, fine. He said, but I don't have any time. He said, I'd like to help you. And I said to him, well, you eat lunch, right? He said, well, actually, on Fridays, I eat lunch. He says, the rest of the time, I may or may not have time, but I do other stuff. I said, well, okay, how about this? If you actually take, he said he took an hour on Fridays for lunch, just to sort of relax. I said, do you like Italian food? And he said, who doesn't like Italian food? I said, well, how about this? Every Friday, I will make you an Italian dish. You tell me what you want, I'll make it for you. While you're eating lunch, I'm gonna ask you some questions. And you know, you don't have to do any preparation, just I wanna see what's in your head. And he said, look, he said, we'll try it for a month or two. And I said, okay, what do you want first? And he said, I don't care. So anyway, the following Friday, I show up with, I don't know, lasagna or something. And it was wonderful because I'd ask him a question. And if he didn't know the answer, and a lot of them he hadn't thought about, he didn't even know what a nurse practitioner was. And so, but he'd tell me where I could go in the legal library and find the answer. So then I'd do that. And then the next week I'd come back and I told him the answer that I found and we'd go on from there. Well, we did that for a whole year, 9 months, the whole 9 months. And we actually wrote a paper together that was published. And it was beautiful. So
that's a very cool story about, you know, an innovative way of setting up a mentoring relationship.
Well, that's about it. I mean, he's as close to a mentor as I ever had. I mean, and look, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. There's no question. And fortunately, I'm a pretty decent cook. So it was just, we had such a wonderful relationship like that. So I learned a lot about the law. And then from Rashi Fine and others, I learned about health economics. And I wrote the book. And I also then worked at the Roxbury Community Clinic. I wanted to see how that was run. And I did that. And it was interesting. The year after I left, they had to close the clinic because they burned somebody in that. Of course, I knew when I drive up, I did that every Tuesday night, a police officer who patrolled that clinic came out to meet me at my car. And he'd walk me into the clinic, and of course he'd stay outside to watch so nobody would touch my car. I had an old jalopy, a piece of junk, but hey, it did me okay. And I learned a lot there. I learned about how these people had nothing and they had a free clinic. You know, I mean, they could come in and there were ways we did stuff. And so that year was invaluable.
How did it change your perspective, those experiences?
Well, you know, I had been treating poor people at Hopkins and that, but at Hopkins, I actually worked in a free clinic, but this was a different clinic because it was in Boston, not in Baltimore. And it was a different kind of culture. It was amazing. They were all Afro-Americans, very poor, beautiful people, but slightly different cultures. And see, Baltimore, I didn't realize how much of a Southern city it is, but a lot of those people were from the South. Whereas in Boston, they were more acclimated to the North. And it was just a different culture. But, you know, the problems and everything else was the same. So in the meantime, I said, look, I got to start working. And I want to work with the poor. I want to start a nurse practitioner program to see if it works. And so I rode around the different places and people told me who was looking for a pediatrician. And there were three. There was one in Los Angeles, the Martin Luther King Clinic. There was Meharry, and there was Columbia Babies. And so it was interesting because while I was doing that, my chair of pediatrics at Hopkins had gone to Wisconsin. And he had wanted me to go straight and work with him. He wanted me to be the dean of the new School of Allied Health Sciences. I said, I'm just finishing my training. And he said, but Allied Health, you're a nurse, you're going to have an MPH, you're a doctor. I said, but that's not what I want to do. I'm a doctor. I want to be a doctor. Now, I want to train somebody to work with me and we'll be able to organize. But I said, so I'm going to take a job, but I'm not coming to Wisconsin as the dean. I said, but I have these three opportunities and I'm just calling for your advice. And he said, no question. He said, I want you to go to Columbia. And I said, why? He said, first of all, it's East Coast and you're an East Coast person. And he said, second of all, I know you. You're going to learn a lot there. You're going to teach a lot there. But after 2 years, you're going to want to expand. And then I want you to come here. I said, I'll never go there as the dean. He said, no, I'll find another dean. He said, but you will come and work here after 2 years. I bet anything. I said, well,
This is Dr. Cook, right?
Right. This is Bob Cook. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I took the job at Columbia. It was wonderful. The funny thing is, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew how I wanted to start the program. But one of the things that I loved was that there were four hospitals affiliated with Columbia. Well, three affiliated with Columbia. There was Columbia. There was Harlem Hospital. St. Luke's and Roosevelt Hospital, all working in the poor sections. And they covered one of the schools in Harlem. And I thought, perfect. My first class, I'm gonna get a couple nurses from each of those places so that we can have the whole variety. But I knew, I knew that I'd have to pay some people to help teach. And I'm thinking, I didn't have any money. That was my first job. And so somebody told me about the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Maggie Mahoney, who was one of their vice presidents. So I just wrote this letter to her, one page. And then on the second page, I wrote the budget for, I don't know, I think it was $8,210.17, something stupid like that. And I sent it to her. And 3 days after I mailed it, she called me. God bless her. And she said, are you a nun? I said, no, what made you say that? She says, you write a budget like a nun. She said, look, Robert Wood Johnson doesn't fund programs like this, but this looks fascinating. She said, so what I want you to do, she said, I want you to wait 1 hour. And then I want you to call the New York Community Trust. Here's the phone number. And you ask for Mr. Whatever. And she said, he will know because I will have talked to him. Now, I want you to go there and describe what this program is. And you tell them you need $10,000. I said, no, no, I only need $8,000. No, no, no. You ask for, and I'm not even sure it was 10. It may have been 20,000, whatever it was. Because I had to pay the nurses too, because they were taken off. And so I said, well, okay. So I waited, I called, they said, yes. His secretary answered, yes, yes. She said, we'd like you to come here tomorrow at 9 o'clock and you can, okay. So I told the people where I was working, the outpatient, I said, I need to go. And they said, yeah, okay, go ahead, we'll cover. Because there were no nurse practitioners then. I was just seeing patients, taking call, covering, but it wasn't my day to cover the clinic, so I was okay. So I go down to the, take a taxi, not a taxi, I took the subway, went down there. I walk in a room and there's about 8 or 9 people. And I told them who I was. I told them what I wanted to do. And I handed them a budget. I just said $10,000. I didn't say what it was for, because they said, we know, you know, Miss Mahoney called us and that. And after I finished explaining, they said, would you wait outside, please? And I said, sure. So I'm sitting outside. And about 15, 20 minutes later, the gentleman comes out and he hands me a check made out to Baby's Hospital, the pediatrics department, for 10 or 20,000, whatever I asked for. And I said, well, gee, thank you. He said, what we want, though, is a year from now, you come and give us a report on how well we spend our money. I said, I will do that.
That's the deal.
I said, I'd be happy to give you reports. He said, no, just 1 year from now. He said, I'll expect you in whatever it was. I said, fantastic. So I take the subway back and I go into Dick Behrman, who was the chair of the department there. I went into his office. I said to the secretary, I said, is Dr. Behrman around? And she said, yeah, he's in there. He's busy. What is it that you want? And now his door is open. I said, well, I have a check here for, I don't know, $10,000. For what? I said, it's made out the Baby's Hospital, because I'm going to, for my nurse practitioner program. He comes tearing out of his office. He said, what do you have? I said, I had money for my program, the New York Community Trust. He said, did you go through the research department? I said, what research department? He said, oh my God. And he said, what's this for? And I told him, and he knew I was the programmer because he was all for it. He said, you can't just do this. I said, well, I don't know. I just went down there. And he said, my God, this check is, he said, come with me. So we go down to the research office.
And you're goes, a green faculty member.
It's funny. And he walks in there and he calls the guy who's a businessman. He said, don't ask. Don't ask. Just deposit this. And it's Dr. DeAngelis has the access to this money. She knows what to use it for. He said, and he said, but Dick, he said, don't ask. I said, okay. I mean, it was, I'm so naive. But you know, that's okay.
Yeah, you were a learning young faculty member.
That's it. Yeah. So, you know, the rest was history. It was an incredible program. And I went, actually what I did is I went to the dean of nursing, and she was the director of nursing for the hospital and dean of the school of nursing. Her name was Mary Crawford. And so I got an appointment. I went in there and I said, Ms. Crawford, you know, I'm Dr. DeAngelis, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to start this program, blah, but it really, it's a nursing program. So I said, I have the grant, the money for it. I have the doctors. I will teach most of it. We'll have some of your nurses, whoever you want. And, you know, but the budget's in my name, but you tell me how you want to spend it. And she went bonkers. How dare you? You have no jurisdiction over nurses. Get out of my office and don't ever come back here. What kind of harebrained idea is this? Yes, ma'am. So I walked out. I paid some nurses to teach. I wanted the nurses to teach too. And after about 4 months in, everybody wanted to take the damn course. And the hospitals, who each of them spared two nurses, and they didn't want the nurses to be paid because they said they would go 2 days. See, they would spend 2 days in the mornings with me. No, 3 days, Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the mornings, they'd spend with me teaching, and I had some other people teach some stuff. And in the afternoon, they could go back and work. And they were going to, I had a commitment from a doctor in each of them that would precept them so that they could start to, you know, see patients and stuff. What was incredible, because when we had the graduation, it was a one-year certificate program. When we had the graduation exercise, the place was packed. That we graduated 12 people. The only one I had to pay a little bit was my friend Phyllis, who was a former Mary Knoll nun who came. And she just needed enough to, you know, for expenses, because actually she was essentially living with me, you know. So we graduated and Mary Crawford came and said, I was wrong. I want to be part of this program. I said, wonderful. It belongs in the School of Nursing. It's all yours, you know? And
what did you learn from that process, you know, going to her and having that terribly negative reaction? And then
I'd had it before from nurses. I was a traitor. I left nursing and I became a doctor. I never wanted to be a nurse, but I'm so happy I did become a nurse. But anyway, I wanted to be a doctor.
Were there other ways in which that program was controversial? I mean,
Oh, yeah, because the nurses said, you know, you want to practice medicine, you go to medical school. Doctors were against it. I mean, the doctors, for an example, the Kentucky Frontier Nursing Service is one of the greatest programs that ever lived. And when they went into Kentucky and started taking care of mostly mothers and babies, they cut the mortality rate in half of both the babies and the mothers. But the doctors threatened to sue them and get them thrown in jail for practicing medicine without a license. So they had to stop. And what happened? The mortality rate went back up. So, you know, but that wasn't going to happen with us because it was a doctor who, you know, we had it under our umbrella. Mm-hmm. And
so did you have a plan for addressing some of that within the institution itself? I mean, did you, you know?
Well, I knew the law. I knew the law. Mm-hmm. And I knew that there were physicians' assistants. I'm blocking his name. I'll think of it in a minute. The person who started the PA program, he had come back from the service and he wanted the nurses to take this course, and they threw him out too. So he said, screw you. He says, I'll get other people, not nurses, and I'll train them. We're going to have a course and blah, 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 blah. And so, but with me, because I was a nurse, and because I, some kind of, I don't know, I knew that I was within the law. They were working, nurses worked with doctors all the time. And, you know, and then what I started to do was, because the nurses then, they took a real load of patients in the outpatient department. And of course, there was always either me or there were two other doctors who precepted them. And so I made an arrangement with the pharmacist, which was on the same floor as this clinic, that they could sign. Mm-hmm. But only for certain, there were basic antibiotics and some other respiratory kinds of things. Nothing, mostly antibiotics, okay? And skin stuff and that. It was very funny because about a month into this, it was working beautifully, because afterwards I would go, or whoever was covering would go there and would see them and then would countersign for them. And I was covering the clinic and they were really busy. So I took a patient and I saw the kid. It was not something, but he needed antibiotics. So I wrote the prescription, and the woman, the mother, went over to the pharmacy and there was a young pharmacist there, okay? And the mother came back and she says, Dr. D, they won't fill this prescription because it has to be signed by a nurse practitioner. And I said, what? And the others were standing around me and they howled. So I went over to the pharmacy and I said, young man, I'm Dr. DeAngelis. This is a program. He said, oh, you're Dr. DeAngelis. I said, yeah. He said, well, yeah, you're going to countersign the nurse practitioners when you're done. I said, no, I don't need a nurse practitioner. The nurse practitioner didn't see this patient. I did. And then the head pharmacist came over and said, what's going on? I mean, it was so funny.
That really is. That's culture change in action.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
That's a great story. Yeah.
But he's right. See, one of the people who took the program was someone who was a teacher. She taught nursing at, I forget which hospital, but she took this course and I said, Dolores Jackson was her name. I said, Dee, I knew that after the second year, I was bored. I knew what I wanted to do. And I said, how would you like to be the director of this program? And she said, you're kidding. I said, no. And so she took it. Mm-hmm. And she directed it. And every one of those nurses, actually, almost all of them went on and got their bachelor's degree. Even though most of them were not bachelors to start out, but they went on for it. There were a couple who had their bachelor's degree, but those got their master's degree, and every one of them continued to work. Some of them are still working.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you know, I've talked to other women for this interview program and also in my work with MD Anderson, you know, who've had an interest in public health issues. And, you know, they've all said that that is real, it's unusual, you know, for people going in it through a traditional academic medicine pathway to broaden their perspective in that way. And you're nodding. So, you know, what is your take on why that's unusual for folks who are going through medical school?
It's not anymore.
Right. Well, but at the time.
Not anymore, but at the time. Well, because, you know, traditionally it's one doctor, one patient. And you don't think about, hey, this may be good for the one patient, but if every one patient was treated like this, we'd run out of money for 3/4 mm-hmm. of the population. Mm-hmm. So you have to think more broadly. Mm-hmm. And that's the perspective. And you have to think like prevention. Prevention is better than treatment. Because mm-hmm. if you can prevent the problem, the thing is, you know, nobody gets excited because somebody comes in and gets a vaccinated, except now with the COVID vaccine, okay? But, you know, you get vaccinated against DPT and pertussis and diphtheria and tetanus and measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis, the whole thing. Nobody gets excited about that. But if you got a patient who came in with measles, everybody get excited, you see? And that's not the way you should think. You have to think prevention.
What is it that you think gave you that perspective, that you know, impulse to always look more broadly at the patient in their context?
Nursing. Okay. My background in nursing, I wouldn't trade for anything. I mean, I told you about the encounter when I was a medical student and was covering the male unit in the VA hospital. And I went on rounds one morning and I'm in rounds and I hear this ruckus. We hear this ruckus down the hall because these were wards. These were not private rooms. And they were like 8-bed wards. And we heard this ruckus coming from down the hall. And it was a patient arguing with the head nurse and another nurse. And he kept saying, I'm not going till I could say goodbye to my nurse. And she was saying, this is your nurse. No, she's not my nurse. And so, you know, we were being interrupted by this. And the person who was on, who was attending, I said, sir, maybe excused, I think I know what's going on down there. And he said, yeah, go. He said, get them quiet. So I went down and I just walk up to him and he goes, there's my nurse. And he comes over to me and he hugs me. And he said, I just want to thank you so much. And the head nurse said, she's not a nurse. She's a student doctor. He said, look, she talked to me like a nurse. She treated me like a nurse. She touched me like a nurse. She's my nurse. And I said, ma'am, I am a trained nurse. I'm also in medicine. I'm a medical student, but I am a trained nurse. And she looked at me and she had this broad smile. And the guy was so happy. He said, now I can leave. And then I went back to rounds. Mm-hmm. But right there, it's a different perspective. In medicine, you're not taught about prevention. You're taught about curing illnesses. And that's as it should be. But now we're much more into the prevention.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you're talking about, I mean, what that particular patient was responding to was also a kind of additional humanity in the interaction with him that perhaps spring.
It was interesting because a bunch of my classmates asked me if I would teach them how to deal with the patient in bed. How do you help them move? What would you, you know, we play different scenarios. And I did that. It's just a different approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Part of it is maybe being a woman, but men, I know men, of course, I mean, who are just as gentle.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be given permission to do it.
Mm-hmm. And maybe women do it more easily
just because that's it comes natural to us.
Right, right. Yeah. Interesting. Now, why were you bored? After two.
Why was I bored? Well, because I knew what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted to go to Hopkins. I wanted to bring general pediatrics, that whole concept. I wanted to bring it to Hopkins. I didn't want Hopkins to be only a subspecialty place. And I'm going to tell you something. I learned something yesterday. I'm on the promotions committee for pediatrics. And one of the new tracks we have for promotion is you become a professor of clinical pediatrics, not a clinical professor. You are a professor, but of clinical pediatrics. And one of the things is you got to show excellence. You got to be among the top 25% in your field. Okay, so one of the people who happened to have been 1 year behind me in training at Hopkins said, I don't understand it. How can you ever determine that a general pediatrician is the best? What kind of criteria? And I mean, I was floored. And I said, Leslie, you were trained in a place when we didn't have general pediatrics here. So you really don't understand. I said, you know, there are all kinds of ways. People send patients to you for second opinions. People in the area who could have any doctor come to you because they want you to take care of their kids. You are noted for being an excellent diagnostician, not in any specialty, but in you're presented with the case that's not obvious. You make the diagnosis. And I knew she couldn't quite get it. And that's the problem. If you don't understand the worthiness of general pediatric, I mean, you look at it now. Everybody needs a general physician. But who are the worst paid?
Yeah.
The general physicians.
Right. And there seems like there's a hierarchy of the specialties. And so
you're looked down on
certain specialties. You know, some are more worthy than others. And
yeah.
Because I kind of encoded in that comment of hers is how, why would you even bother to establish their worth?
Well, this is the point. It's not outhouse medicine. It is real medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you're the doctor, you figure out what's wrong with this patient. You don't have somebody walk into you that's obviously a diabetic or obviously, God bless them, have cancer. Or, you know, you just have patients come to you.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's interesting that, you know,
so the board was, I wanted to prove that this was a program that could be initiated and could thrive because I wanted to go back to Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I had to prove to myself it could be done. So I picked up the phone and I called Bob Cook and I said, all right, now I'm going to, I said, you were right. I've done what I can here at Columbia. He said, I know what you've done there. He said, I've been talking to Dick Behrman all along. He said, now you're ready to come here. I said, not as the dean. No, he said, no, he said, we would like you to come here as a consultant because, you know, we are in competition with outstanding pediatric groups, and we barely have enough patients in our general clinic. And it's hard for our residents to, you know, to see enough patients. And would you come in and help us? I said, well, yeah, as a consultant, I'll come. So I spent 2 days touring the place, listening to all this stuff. And I said, this is easy. So I outlined to them on the blackboard what they needed to do. And the chief of peds, I just see him with his pipe. He's smoking it and he says, it'll never happen. Can't be done. And some of the other doctors are shaking their head. I said, oh, yes, it could be done. Absolutely, this can be done. It has to be done or you're going to lose your accreditation. Well, we don't want to tick off the private practice doctors here. And I said, yeah. And the private practice doctors don't want to lose the residents, do they? And they said, well, yeah. I said that this is the way to solve the problem. And, you know, they said, well, where are we going to get the patients? I said, any patient they don't want, we'll take. I said, don't you have graduate students here? Well, yeah. Who takes care of their kids? Well, you know, the doctors in town. And I said, aren't these graduate students from all over the world? They said, well, yeah. And I said, and this is pure white Wisconsin. Now, I said that in a private group. And I said, guess what? You know, this can be done. So Bill Seeger, who's the chair, looks at me and he says, well, come put your money where your mouth is. I mean, he played me and I knew I was being played, but I thought, why not? Why not Wisconsin? So I went to Wisconsin and I started the program and it was a success like you can't believe. And we had 1,000 patients within 2 months.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Because I went up to where the graduate student, it was a place called Eagle Heights. Mm-hmm. There were 700 or 650 or 700 families up there, and each had a couple kids. Mm-hmm. And it was, so we set up a clinic in what was, well, it was a basketball court, but they had a co-op store with stuff from all over the world, so, you know, and different kinds of spices and that. And we took a couple rooms. And it was interesting because you'd walk in there and the aromas were fantastic, all the spices. And then, of course, the alcohol from the. So it was wonderful. And then after 3 years there, I thought it was time that I could come to Hopkins because they were looking for someone to run the outpatient. And so at that point, I was, I wanted to go back to the East Coast anyway, and Rochester wanted me to go there and run their program. Now, Rochester already had a very good general pediatric program. It was pretty well established, but they wanted me to come and to run the whole, that whole program. And so when I went for an interview there, Jim and I at that point were commuting back and forth, talking to each other in that. And he said that, he said, why don't you come and look at this job? And I said, well, okay, when I'm, the next time I'm gonna go for an interview at Rochester, I will be interviewed there. Well, I was interviewed by the outpatient chief resident, the chair of pediatrics, who was no longer Bob Cook, obviously. He's a wonderful gentleman, but he was an internist, actually. This was at Hopkins. Mm-hmm. Now, I had just come from being interviewed at Rochester by the department chair, all the directors of the programs, and was offered an incredible salary and all kinds of resources. And I said, you know, I need a weekend to think about it. And they said, okay. So I came back, and I was interviewed at Hopkins, and it was a disgrace. So I said to Jim, I'm going to Rochester.
At that interview at Hopkins?
Well, I was interviewed by the outpatient chief resident, mm-hmm. and by the department chair, who hadn't a clue what I was talking about, but he's a wonderful gentleman. He's a terrific guy. But he just thought, this is Hopkins. Why would you want to go anywhere else? Okay. So he said, yes, you know, we'd like you to come here and blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine.
Did they talk resources at all, or?
No, they said, you come and we'll talk about what you know.
Yeah, so it was just.
And you'll report to Bob Drachman, who was running the outpatient department. And, but it was a disgrace. So I said to Jim, that's it. I'm going back to Wisconsin. I'm going to take the job at Rochester.
I think it was because you were a woman they did that?
No, I don't think so. But what happened was, Jim said, well, will you come back next week? He said, next Saturday, he said, he was then offered a job at Hopkins, he said, and they're going to have a reception for me. Would you please come? And I said, well, yeah, I could do that. I'll come back. And so I came back, and at that party on a Saturday night, it was 1 week later, I told the people at Rochester that I needed a week or so to think about it, not a day. But because I was going to look at another place. But anyway, the chair of PEDS, John Littlefield, came up to me, and he said, I can't believe that you're going to take a job at Rochester over Hopkins. And I'd had a glass of wine at that point. And I said, Dr. Littlefield, with all due respect, I said, when I compared the way I was interviewed and how valued I felt and what they offered me, and then I came to Hopkins, and you had the nerve to set me up with the outpatient chief resident, who I like very much. He's a friend of mine, in fact. No division chiefs, and you who... You know, you were very polite and kind, but let me tell you who interviewed me at Rochester. And I gave him all that stuff. And I said, this is what they offered me. Now, what would you take? He said, I didn't know. I said, obviously you didn't. I said, I want to come here and establish a program. I don't want to come here as outpatient chief. I want to establish a program. And he said, is there any chance we can talk more about this? I said, well, yeah, but I'm going to have to give Rochester something. He said, can we have breakfast tomorrow morning at my house? He said, and I'll get Dr. Drachman out there too. And I said, of course. So we're pulling into his house, and Jim said, well, what do you think? I said, there's probably one chance in 10,000 that they'll come up with what I want. And so we met, And I said, he said, what do you want to come here? And Drachman was there too. I said, I want my own program. I want my salary and the salary of one other person. I want 12 of the first year residents. There were 18. I want 12, one a month. And then I'm going to set up these clinics and that. And we're going to take the patients from the ER. When they see them, we'll get them in this clinic. And Drachman, who, you know, he didn't know anything. God love him. And I said, but Dr. Drachman runs the program. I do not want to report to Dr. Drachman. I said, Bob, I love you very much. I knew him from when I was a resident. But I'm not going to report to anybody but the department chair because I want a program. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do something and I'm going to start my own division and you're going to be proud of it. He said, wonderful. And the rest is history.
Cool. That's a good story. Would you mind if we leave it here today? We've done an hour and I like to
Okay.
Hour increment. No. So they do the hour increment so I can check the recording and make sure.
Sure.
All right. Well, that's a really amazing story. And
I'm sorry I get carried away.
No, that's fine. It's my job to keep track of the details. So okay. we're good for this time again tomorrow?
Tomorrow is
Wednesday. Okay. Well,
my surrogate brain here. Let me see.
Yeah. While you're checking, let me just say I'm turning off the recorder at 13 minutes after 2:00.